a little bit of a jump. We're on 19A. Yud Tet Amud Aleph. Page 19A, Yud Tet Amud Aleph. In the English, it's 19A1 toward the bottom of the page. In between, the material that we skipped was material relating to the regel, the laws of Chol HaMoed. And now, the Gemara, well, here the Mishnah, actually for the first time, the Mishnah itself deals with the subject of Avelut, the mourning, issues of mourning. Okay? And some of the things that we already said, because we know them, are only now going to be developed. And keep in mind that what we will read in the Mishnah, and you will see it right away, will disturb you in light of what we've already said, because it's not what we've already said. Namely, the law as in the Mishnah, in fact, is not the law that you and I know, and not the law that we have mentioned in relation to the issues that you will see now discussed in the Mishnah. Okay? Hakover et meto shlosha yamim kodem laregel. He who buries his dead 3 days before the festival, but lai menu gzerat shiva. The restrictions of Shiva are cancelled for him. Shmona bat luay menu gzerat shloshim. If 8 days have passed since the burial, then shloshim is cancelled. Mipnei she'amru shabbat ola ve'einam afseket. Regalim mafsikim ve'einan olim. For the sages have said, the Shabbat is included, but the regel, the festivals, cut short and are not included. Rabbi Eliezer, I'm just going to read through it first and then I'll explain it to you. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, mi shecharav bet hamikdash, atzeret kashabbat. Once the temple was destroyed, Atzeret, which means Shavuot, was considered like Shabbat. Rabban Gamliel Omer, Rosh Hashanah v'Yom HaKippurim k'regalim. Rosh Hashanah and Yom HaKippurim are dealt with as regalim. The Chachamim Omrim, and the sages say, lo k'divrei zeh v'lo k'divrei zeh. It is not according to the first one, it is not according to the second one, what we have just read, Ela Atzeret Kirigalim, but rather Shavuot is treated like a regel, like a festival, Rosh Hashanah v'Yom HaKippurim k'Shabbat. And Rosh Hashanah and Yom HaKippurim are dealt with as a Shabbat. Okay? We'll start over again with the Mishnah. Let's just not ask any questions yet, because it, I hope it's, if it's comprehensible, you're really quite something. So I don't think it's comprehensible to anybody. Okay? First, akover et meto. Oh, thank you. Okay? Did you enjoy him?
Oh, yeah.
It's a cute kid. I like that last one with Himalaya there.
Yes.
She's quite a... She carries him in this carrier, you know. And she said that she tries to tire him out during the day. And the only way she can do that is if he looks forward. If he looks backwards, it's just so calming. He just, it's the bouncing. He just falls asleep. But if he's always looking forward, there's always something happening there. So that's why she turns him around and puts him forward. That's like the funny faces. The Buddha looks out.
How old is she?
Chamele is 22. She was just 22. Just, you remember when she was a little girl, right? After the, she wasn't very old when we started ours. Well, ours I really was 17 years old. She was five. You remember, you were there at the beginning.
Pretty much.
Yeah, pretty much. Okay. Okay. Hakover metav, he who buries his dead. Now, first of all, the language is important. Hakover et metav, he who buries his dead. Let's take a look at just see where you got this. Look, take a look at the first Tosafot, the Tosafot that deals with Hakover Meto. Tosafot, remember, is down next to the Gemara text, but on the left side. It's now down about two-thirds of the way on the page. Okay? Two-thirds of the way on the page. See? It says Hakover et Meto in big letters. Everybody have that? Who wants it? You're 19A. Yud Tet Amud Aleph.
Where's 19A? Yud Tet Amud Aleph. Okay. Hakover et Meto.
Okay. Anybody else want it who doesn't have it? Okay. Let's read the Tosafot. Hakover Meto, he who buries his dead. And of course, the Mishnah, you remember, now talks about a number of days passing, and then the regel comes and cuts off the Shiva. So and it's phrased, he who buries his dead, the regel comes, cuts off the Shiva. Right? Gives us a certain number of days. Hakover meto, lahachi nakat kover. It is with reason that it is formulated in terms of he who buries his dead, he who buries, as opposed to it could have said he who begins sitting Shiva. Instead, it very specifically uses the language of Hakover Meto, da'avelut matchelet misha'at stimata golel, in order to make the point that mourning begins from the moment of the closing of the grave. Kida amrin in the Kaman, as it says further on in Daf 27. Now, that's a very important point that's established right here through the language in the Mishnah, that mourning does not begin until the moment of the completion of burial. That's the beginning of mourning. Mourning does not begin a minute before that. Doesn't begin with the funeral. Okay, certainly doesn't begin before that. And no matter how much time takes place, except in odd and special circumstances. The odd and special circumstances would be where you don't really have a burial, let's say. But this even has implications in terms of a reburial. Let's say somebody is buried somewhere, and you disinter them. There is a whole issue of the extent to which there is any obligatory mourning at the point of the next interment. It's a complicated issue, and it isn't a regular mourning period, but there is a certain amount that suddenly becomes an issue because of the act of burial itself. Burial is considered to be crucial. Burial is considered to be crucial. So that's when it begins. And the whole timing of everything, as far as the Shiva goes and as far as the Shloshim goes, that timing is based on the burial. Okay? Now, in this country, we bury only in the day. In Israel, they bury at night. I've never been to a night burial in my whole life. I've never been. But in Israel, they do it at night. Also at night. Also at night.
But that's only lately. I don't know.
Well, I shouldn't even make a general statement because you know your experience. I can tell you it is Minag Yerushalayim. In Jerusalem, they will bury at any time of the day or the night. It makes no difference. And the alleged reason for it all is that you want to hasten a burial.
Oh.
You hasten a burial. You bury as soon as possible. And as soon as possible means as soon as possible. If it's 2 o'clock in the morning, perfectly fine, that means as soon as possible. So you bury basically as soon as a death occurs, you go into gear immediately, assuming that the circumstances are such that you can go into gear to do that. And there are all kinds of odd situations. Someone's born die in one place and they have to be buried in another place. I'm not saying that you have to quickly and go and find the nearest grave and bury a person. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying, given the assumption that you will be buried locally, there is no impediment if it's the nighttime. If it's the nighttime. So,
if you can assemble them, that's part of the logistics.
2 in the morning, you have.
Yeah.
Sure. Within Yerushalayim, you'll have all kinds of things. I mean, generally, that's not what happens. Generally, there's a certain level of normal time that these things are done. They're usually not done, to my knowledge, after midnight, because people want to sleep. Excuse me.
So it could be an evening funeral.
Well, realize a funeral means something different than it means to us too. Israelis don't have the funerals that we have. They don't have, to my knowledge, funeral chapels. There's no such thing as a chapel. Everything is at the cemetery. Some cemeteries have a sort of a receiving area where the tahara is done. It's by the
schacha.
Yeah, it's like a shed.
Like a shed.
So we saw that, as a matter of fact, when we walked through the cemetery in Sfat last year. You got down to the bottom, and we washed our hands, went to the bathroom, down in what you've just called the schacha. That was what we learned was the tahara area. So you would come, and the tahara would be done, the ritual purification would be done there in that place, and that's where the funeral also would happen.
And they call it sha'ar.
Like sha'ar?
Sha'ar, yeah, because usually the way they design it.
Excuse you, the sha'ar bet akvarot.
To the avenue that goes into.
Correct. That's right, because that's the entryway into
so
the
you
cemetery.
There, and immediately you go behind it, and that's the sha'ar, and you go through the funeral, the avenue,
right.
The place.
As far as I know, that's the way in which funerals are conducted in South America as well. I'm going in another 2 weeks to Mexico for the meeting of the Rabbinical Assembly, and one of the reasons that I want to go is because I just really haven't had that much experience with South American Jewry, and that is what this convention is going to be about. It's going to be about South America. And what I remember...
Mexico is about South America.
Well, but to all the rabbis... to the rabbis it is. It's called South of the Border. It's called South America. So... But as far as I know, they don't have... There's a funeral chapel, that funerals take place on the cemetery, as far as I know, in South America.
I'm talking about the beginning of the burial or the completion of the burial? Because what if the actual burial process is interrupted?
They're talking about the completion of the burial, of the burial. And, in fact, that happens once in a while. I mean, it's usually... I'll tell you when it's interrupted. In my experience... Only time I've had a few cases where there's been an interruption. An interruption once you actually begin it. Well, no, the most common, I'll tell you what it is. No, it's not even that. It's that the casket is too big for the grave. What's happened now, this is a problem that we have now, they're making caskets bigger than the graves that were contracted for, because people are getting bigger. In fact, people are bigger today than they were 50 years ago. So caskets, the standard casket is larger. However, a plot that you bought 50, 60 years ago is not larger. It's the same plot. And there may be, just the way the cemetery does it, there's a certain variety. Right now, we're going through this. Sometimes you end up with a casket that's too big for the grave. So, it's a word to the wise. You should just don't take anything for granted, particularly if you have an old cemetery where the cemetery doesn't have a lot of burials. When you have a lot of burials, it's always being used. They know these things. I mean, so people are adapted to it. Where you have a cemetery that has relatively few burials, then they're not always right on top of things. So that's where I've found, and it's an awful thing to deal with, absolutely awful, because you just try and you can't get the casket down. And it goes down sideways, and then everybody starts screaming, and it is absolutely terrible. not pleasant. But you do what you do. What are you going to do? You try to do it. You do everything as reasonable as possible. But that's been my most common problem.
So what actually demarcates the end of a burial?
Stimata golem. The language here, which is worthwhile sitting upon for a moment, the language is stimata golel. That means the closing off of the stone, because the imagery here is a biblical image of rolling a stone. You roll a large stone to cover the cave, in effect. That's really the image here. So stimata golel means closing off the goal, rolling the stone to close it off. In our terms, what that means, and it's an interesting issue, because what do you have to see before you say Kaddish? That's really the practical side of this too. At what point can you say Kaddish? You cannot say Kaddish until the stimata golel. So when is stimata golel? Early on in my rabbinate, it was extremely rare to actually see this. You would never see it, and you still won't see it in the Reform movement. And I would say 95% of the conservative rabbis never covered the casket, and certainly not the grave. If anything, it was just filled in slightly. Well, but whoever does it, the Kaddish would be said before that. When I started out, I have some of these issues, and I was always felt that this was a shanda to see it, that kind of practice. So in my early
saying Kaddish before,
and it's also what happens is that people leave the grave. So that the psychology is that you leave a hole in the ground. The traditional way of doing it is that you leave a flat, the ground is flat. And I always...
Completely filled in.
Everything is filled in. Whoever fills it in. But that when you leave, and when you say Kaddish with the ground flat, as opposed to a hole in the ground. That's the traditional way of doing it. So I've always insisted on that, and it's got me in trouble. It used to get me in trouble in the early days because I found, to my surprise, that it was simply not being done in the conservative movement. The conservative rabbis were not doing that. It's being done more today. It was the young rabbis who brought it back. The older rabbis were kind of horrified by the experiences that they had in the yeshiva world. Remember, the generation before me and the conservative rabbi are all yeshiva grads. They all went to YU or similar institutions, Tor HaVadas, people like that. It's our generation that didn't go to those institutions. And it was the people who went into the conservative movement from the Orthodox world, they didn't want to see any of this. And it was then the next generation that came back to it. But the tradition is, therefore, that you fill in. You actually fill in. And stimata golel, therefore, at the very least, means covering the casket. At very least means covering the casket. It should mean, in my opinion, covering the entire grave until you are at the level of the ground. That is what it should mean. And the psychology is just so much better, frankly. It takes longer, naturally. And that was the reason that it was not done, is because the length of time was considered to be just too distressing. I found it to be exactly the opposite. If you press, what happens is that when you leave the grave, it is so much more comforting, because essentially the mental image that you carry with you is an image of completion, as opposed to not completion. I had a case once where I actually had to go back with a family to the grave, because there was a young woman who was fantasizing that somebody stole her father out of the grave. And that's natural, and that's what happens in the mind. The mind pictures all kinds of things that are much worse than what actually is. That's why I find that from a psychological perspective, as much as you can actually witness stimata golel and leave at that point, though there is a certain amount of anxiety that's involved with it because it takes longer, the long-term effects are extremely beneficial.
Who fills the grave?
You fill in, either you try to fill in as much as you can with the immediate people who are involved. And that can mean anybody who is immediately involved. It doesn't by any means have to be the family. Very frequently, I surely never push that. But I've been surprised. I found it very interesting. Most young people really feel that this is an extraordinary experience and they want to do it. Doesn't matter if they're members of the family. The old days used to say, let the other people do it. Now, people really feel that this is a very meaningful experience to have and they want to take part. You go from there to, those of you who have been at the funerals at which I've officiated know that I then ask for anyone who is present who would like to participate, and people will then come forward. And my experience is more and more people actually do this. This is what's going on today. More people today than ever before want to do it. And therefore, that's what you do. If you run out of people because of fatigue, because of the depth of the grave, you then call in the gravediggers. And the gravediggers then finish up. What we try to do is, as much as possible, complete to the covering of the casket before we call in the gravediggers. But I've found it absolutely fascinating. As time goes on, young people want to do more and more. And that's helpful because they have more energy. They just are more fit to be able to do this kind of heavy labor. And the last few funerals that I've had, I think at each of them, we filled just the people who were there without calling in the gravediggers. Filled everything up. Filled up right to ground level. That was really rare years ago. Years ago, you would hardly ever see that.
Was that all with one shovel?
No, you get several shovels. You order several shovels, and that's normally what they have because there are usually several grave diggers. Since there are several grave diggers, there are automatically several shovels there. You then say, take a shovel, you take a shovel, you take a shovel, and then you go, one goes here, one goes there, and you deal with the pile of dirt, and you try to do it as efficiently as possible.
In the New York area, they don't use bulldozer or something like that?
It's a very interesting issue. In the last few years, they have begun to use bulldozers. I've made an issue of this.
So then the workers are there with the thing revving, you know, the engine.
I won't allow it to be done.
So you warn them in advance, turn the damn thing off?
There are a few things that you do. First of all, if you have any control over the rules, you make those rules, and there's nothing they can do about it. Such as in our negotiations now, in our opening up of our own cemetery, we're just about to go into this business. You got the newsletter, and you see that finally Arzarua has, in fact, we today own a very nice, a sizable piece of land in New Jersey. As close as you can buy any graves to New York City today. It's really it's an amazing thing. And we'll landscape it. It'll look very nice. And there we'll have control. I already broached that with these people in the cemetery. I said, I want to make it quite clear that this will be done by hand and not by machine. This is how they usually say. They say, "Oh, Rabbi, of course. Who would ever think of doing such a thing?" So, nobody ever would think of that. The problem you have is in some of the Westchester cemeteries. I've had this problem. A place like Sharon Gardens, which I mentioned to you because some of you may have plots there, or you may have family that has plots there. Sharon Gardens is a real problem because they have not specified it, and generally they will use the bulldozer. Some of the places in Jersey, other places also out on the island, will today use the bulldozer. In a case like that where I lose control over the situation, what we do is we try to cover the casket, then say Kaddish, leave, let the bulldozer come. Because the bulldozer I find to be an awful thing. It's just so gross to have that kind of machinery come in. It's just totally inappropriate.
I mentioned it because that was my experience in Florida with grandparents.
Uh-huh.
Both my grandmother and grandfather, the bulldozer was revving, but for the people who were mourning, they were just as happy to be out of there. I don't know, psychologically or not, they didn't want to wait.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The truth is, particularly the cohort of people who are today older than I am generally have that approach. Namely, they want to get out of there as soon as possible. The main thing to do is to get out fast. That was really the main thing to do. That has changed over the last years. If people find it to be an extraordinarily moving and helpful experience. That's what I found over the last years. But it's relatively recent. Relatively recent.
They don't use caskets.
Correct. I've never, as I said, I've never been to an Israeli funeral. I know that to be the case. Closest I've ever come was to see Yitzhak Rabin's on television. That's all I know. But they just use mats, as far as I know. You know, your parents were buried.
Tachrichim,
yeah.
And it's no casket. And it's me'afar bata ve'afar tashuv. There is nothing to...
But what happens? How do you lower the body?
No, what they do, they dig the hole. Yes. And then they put blocking. They put this like concrete block aside.
Right.
Like that will be the frame.
Right.
And then one of the burial people or any one of the member goes down and they take the body, the head first, move it up, and then they put the leg down, and then it comes out, and then they put blocks again, the same block to cover it, and then they cut.
They actually put blocks, really?
Yeah, they put blocks. It's like 2.5 inches block by 10 inches.
Interesting.
So it's basically stone. It's
cement
stone.
Blocks.
Cement blocks.
Cement blocks. Yeah.
And they are hollow blocks.
They're hollow. So you mean the dirt goes through, I assume?
Not exactly, but water can go through.
Water can go through. Interesting. Another hand up here.
First to that, the soldiers are buried in coffins.
The only soldiers.
Soldiers are buried
in the
coffins.
Why? Why?
Because they need to move the body after them.
Oh. In wartime. You said in wartime.
No, let's even now.
Not even in the war. Any soldier who died on duty.
Right.
In the front line or in the in a military cemetery is buried in a
coffin.
And you say the reason for that?
Is because soldiers are the only one who you allowed officially to move the body from place to place. Because it's not the final burial.
I see, because the soldier might be first in a military cemetery and then in a family plot.
Right.
Very interesting.
So
they
are the only one who are buried in the coffin.
Also, in a Christian burial, they don't lower the coffin at all, generally. I mean, I've been to a few Christian burials, well, not burials, but on the cemetery, and everybody leaves while the coffin is completely above ground. I find that very disquieting, to walk away and leave the coffin all alone, sitting there by itself. I suppose that it's because of, you know, what I'm accustomed to, but I find that a very disquieting thing, to just walk away and leave the coffin sitting on top of the ground.
You could tell me, that was the only time I ever saw, I've never been to a Christian, but I've been with Christians who have described these things, but I've never been myself. I have seen that done by Reform rabbis. Any of you have experience with Reform burials? What did you see?
Younger, relative when I was a kid, but my recollection is that the coffin was always lowered, but there was a Reform congregation; they would never fill in the grave at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So it was betwixt and between.
Mm-hmm.
Is there such a custom that they take when they put the burial inside? They take out the bottom of the basket.
Yes, I've heard of that. We don't do that, but I've heard of that, where you take out the casket as a removable bottom, actually.
Yes.
So that the body will be on the ground, actually, in effect, or moved slightly, so that the ground will come in and the water will flow more readily.
But I don't think they do it here in
No, I'm not. I haven't seen it done.
That there's a religious reason for this.
Well, I'm sure there is, but we're not exactly irreligious, and we don't do it. There are just different customs. There are customs.
Often
there are
holes in the bottom of the coffin.
Yes,
there
will be holes.
Is the custom to bury in the, or it's the law to bury in a casket,
yes.
Or it's our Jewish tradition to bury? Because I think it's the law that you must bury.
My hunch is that that's true, but I don't know. You know that it's the law.
I think it's
by
the law.
State by state, but.
Well, Florida would be different.
Florida, they put it in a concrete vault.
Yes.
Right.
Oh, no, that, but that's because of different reasons.
Right.
That's because water.
Yeah, well, Florida has water issues, and certain parts of the country have water issues. New Orleans had water issues. I remember friends from New Orleans, and Florida has its issues. But some of these things also, you have to be careful. Sometimes it's just because that was, in effect, Christian practice. Christian practice is largely to bury as a monument, to bury with stone, to have huge caskets, metal caskets as opposed to wooden caskets. Those are, well, but not for the burial, that's for the funeral. But that kind of sort of fortress type of casket is a Christian thing in America, but Jews adopted it because that's the way the local people who were wealthy, you know, that's the way the aristocrats did it. Of course, I remember I had some close friends in the Rockefeller family, and I remember after Nelson Rockefeller was buried, speaking with his nephew, who explained to me how they all stood around Uncle Nelson's grave and threw dirt in the way the Jewish people do, because it's so meaningful.
The way he died.
Well, <okay. laughs> died the way the other people die, but he was buried the way we go.
I'm just wondering, do we have to be buried? Is there a Jewish thing that you have to be prone? Can Jews be buried vertically or any other position?
I don't know the answer to that. I've never heard of Jews being buried vertically. I can imagine a good argument for it, but I've never heard of it being done.
Have been, and, Greeks were like really outside the walls in big urns and everything, so then that was an ancient thing. But also, like, the Prague Cemetery is so, so crowded. I don't know. You know that they have, like, layers.
Oh, yeah, well, that you have.
Layers.
We have, in Israel, we have that. We have layers. The Mount of Olives, basically every few years you start again. You bury in layers. And there were many interesting practices, some of which we know from archaeology and, you know, what we've learned in the Land of Israel. Bodies were disinterred and bones were placed in ossuaries. That was a Jewish practice. We know that because we've got those ossuaries. The stone ossuaries are in the Israel Museum, so we know that was done in places like Tivon, where you have Bet Sha'arim, where you have caves, where the rabbis of the rabbinic period were obviously buried in caves.
Yeah, but then they used to take them out.
After the flesh would decompose, the bones would be removed.
But they were like
slid in. But as far as the vertical burial, to my knowledge, I mean, I've heard of a lot of different customs, but I never heard of that being done.
Because it's too much digging.
It is. It is an awful lot of digging.
I think there's from my personal experience, because we all belong to the same Chevra Kadisha going back to my grandparents. So it's an Orthodox group from the old Moriah Shul on Broadway, which doesn't exist. So I remember.
Moriah doesn't exist anymore?
As a shul?
As a shul, no. When did it cease existing?
Pardon me?
When did it cease existing? It
must be quite some time ago.
Because isn't that where Rabbi Soloveitchik used to give his lectures in Moriah?
Yeah.
That's what I thought.
But, you know, in those days, when I was a kid, everybody came from the same place, so to speak. My grandparents' friends were just like them.
Mm-hmm.
And the family grew up, and so you went to a funeral, it was totally unselfconscious. Even if a kid, it was a little novel.
It's
but
true.
Everybody kind of knew the rules.
Right, the rules, exactly.
It was
not self-conscious.
Always the same and so on. I know now, because it's still the same Chevra Kedisha. The Chevra Kedisha exists because they have the place of Nazareth, Israel. The people who are in charge have been taken over by a new generation of young people that are completely you can't do this, you can't do that.
Right, they're self-conscious about everything.
Within sight. You can't even stay in the car.
Right.
And the people who come, when you come to the funeral, people are from different backgrounds. They're a friend because people work together.
Exactly.
And I can tell you, I think at my mother's funeral, a riot broke out. Because first comes the backhoe, and it was pouring rain. The guy's driving. People are going, oh my God, what's going on? Let's finish. But it was pouring rain. And my aunts were having a fight with the conditions.
Such a need, like a home, man.
We're not continuing if you don't leave right away. So I don't know what you're supposed to do anymore. Because you have basically everybody's from the same milieu, but the ways of seeing things and doing things are what people are used to. As you said, the younger people are becoming more and more sometimes.
These things, it's very interesting. We're going through, you never stop going through these changes, really. It just depends, you're going through a different change, you know, as time goes on. But let's get back to where we were here. Here, a koveret meto, okay? The setting is now, he who buries his dead, it is burial that is the beginning of the mourning period, okay? Shlosha yamim kodem laregel. 3 days before the regel. 3 days before the festival. Batla imenu gzerat shiv'ah. Alright, comes the festival. Comes the festival and it cancels the mourning. So notice what this says. 3 days, if you have 3 days of mourning, and the festival comes, then the rest of the Shiva period is canceled. Let's see if there's some Rashi here. I think there is some Rashi. Look at the Rashi manuscript. Rashi manuscript, just second line down. Let's read it. Hakoveret meto, shemet kodem aregel. A person dies before the regel. V'nihag avelut shlasha yamim, and 3 days of mourning were observed. Kodem aregel, before the festival actually began. But lai menu gzerat shiva. In that case, Shiva, the law of Shiva is cancelled. I'm still reading the Rashi manuscript. Shaharegel mafsik aveluto. Because the regel cancels his mourning. Kedekatani besamuch, as it is explained right next to this, dekevan de nahag shlosha yamim. Since he has already observed 3 days, lifnei regel, before the festival begins, mutar latzeit mipetach peto. It is then possible, it's permissible for a person to leave his house. Now here too, it's very interesting. It is permissible for a person to leave the door of their house. The assumption being that in an ideal circumstance, during mourning you do not leave your home. Even to come to the synagogue. Okay? Ideally, that's the ideal circumstance. You stay at home.
Even on Shabbat?
No, not on Shabbat. Shabbat is different. It is and it is. It is and it isn't. In certain ways it is, in certain ways it isn't. But the exception is Shabbat. Shabbat you are allowed to go out and to go to the synagogue. Okay? So a person is permitted to leave his house. Umutar ba'asiyat melacha. He is permitted to do work. Ve'eno chayav bikfiyat amita. He is no longer obligated to turn over the bed. Remember we learned that about Kfiyat Amita? Debatlu mimenu gzerat shiv'ah. the laws of Shiva have been canceled for him. Okay? Now,
that's all with reference to the regil coming 3 days after.
It's all with reference to the regil coming three days after.
2 days or 1 day.
But it says 3 days.
Well, so here it says, but the footnote goes on and explains that description.
All right. Let's take a look at the second Tosafot, Shlosha Yamin. This is the one underneath Hakover Meitov. It says Shlosha Yamin, 3 days. Kach hu ikar avelut lechama mile. That is the ikar, the most principal, basic time of the mourning period in several different areas. And we'll see that further on. That will be defined. Actually, there are certain types, certain things are prohibited during the first 3 days, which change afterward. They actually change. The law changes after 3 days. We're conscious of the whole 7 day period, but actually there is a slight modification after 3 days in some things. And we'll get to that. V'yamrinan lekaman shlosha yamim lebechi. That's an important phrase which we'll see later on in the Gemara. The first 3 days are for weeping. The psychology there is that during the first 3 days people are so upset that it's the most intense grief. And that as the week goes on, one begins to go to a different place. But 3 days are the time of the most intense grief. Okay? So here you see then that as far as the Mishnah is concerned, that is connected with this psychological reality of intense grief. So you, if you've had, you've been able to have that period, then if the regal comes, it cancels the rest of Shiva. The assumption is, on the other side, if the regal has not come, or, I'm sorry, if the regal comes after 2 days, doesn't cancel the Shiva. Okay? The Shiva probably will have to be observed after the regal. Okay?
Last week we read something. I didn't have that 3 day rule.
Not only that, but that's not the law. That's not the law at all. Okay, let me just see whether the notes here make use of this.
The footnote that you were just reading from continues on.
I was not reading from a footnote. No. Where is
13?
What is it?
Yes, footnote 13 on 19A2.
Footnote 13.
Well, this is the view of our mission of the halakha follows a dissenting view, recorded later in the Gemara on 20A.
Correct. The law is not what we have just read. The law is 1 day, not 3 days.
Even part of a day.
And 1 day can mean even part of a day. Okay, we'll get to that in just a little bit tonight. We'll probably see that the measurement, the termination, whenever we have a termination time, it can be a minimal time. And that is even part of a day is equal to a whole day. Okay, so we see the beginning. Akover mito shlosha yamim kodem aregel batlai menu gzerat shiva. Shmona, okay, if the burial was 8 days before the festival, batlu mimenu gzerat shloshim. Right? Shloshim is canceled if it was 8 days before the festival. Okay? Now, what that would mean is that you have 7 days of Shiva, 1 day of Shloshim. If you have 1 day of Shloshim, then if the regal comes, it cancels the whole thing. Okay? Now, somewhere here is the note that's very useful. Let's look at note 14. The Shloshim period begins after the completion of Shiva and extends until the 30th day from the burial. If Shiva began 8 days before the festival, and the festival eve was the first day of Shloshim. Once Shloshim has begun, the arrival of the festival can cancel it. In short, the arrival of a festival cancels Shiva only if Shiva began sometime, according to our Mishnah, 3 days, according to the dissenting view, even in a very short period of time before the festival. Likewise, a festival cancels Shloshim only if Shloshim began before the festival. But it's actually a little stronger in the Mishnah. It's if there's a whole day of Shloshim, because you have to have had 8 days, is what the Mishnah is saying. Okay? So far, so good? That, too, is not the law. We also don't observe that. But that's what the Mishnah says. Okay? Mipnei she'amru Shabbat Ola ve'ena mafseket regalim mafsikim ve'enan olim. The sages say now that Shabbat Ola, Shabbat is included in the counting of the 7 days of Shiva. Ve'ena mafseket doesn't cut off the Shiva. Shabbat doesn't cut off the Shiva. Regalim mafsikim, but the regal cuts off, ve'enan olim, and they do not count. And they do not count. The days of the regal do not count. So it seems to say. Okay? Now let's just take the Shabbat part of it first so that we're clear about that. It might seem intuitive that everything should be the same. That a Shabbat is a Shabbat, and a Shabbat is important, and a Shabbat is special, and a Shabbat, as you intuitively sense, really you don't mourn on Shabbat in most ways. We said you have to stay in the house, you can go out of the house, and so on. Okay, that's a Shabbat thing. So, if that were to be the case, if Shabbat were actually to be able to cancel Shiva, then you could never have Shiva. The fact is you could never have Shiva. Because there isn't a week when you don't have a Shabbat. So you would never have a Shiva. So the Shiva would just be a theoretical Shiva, it wouldn't be a real Shiva. Okay? And in, I don't know, 6/7 of the cases, if you take the law of average, right, you'd even have one less day. Okay? So, that's the problem with Shabbat. Shabbat is perpetually recurring since Shiva is a 7-day period. And I remind you of that, by the way. I would say most audiences to which I will speak, if you ask, what does Shiva mean? Sitting. You know what they'll say? Sitting. Because they'll know enough Hebrew to know Yeshiva means sitting, okay? Or Shiva can be sitting in some circumstances. Any of you were, Miriam, you were there last night? Anybody else at our meeting, at our dinner last night? No. Shivti bevet Hashem kol yemei chayai. I dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. That is from Shin Bet. Shin Bet, like in Shiva, you might think. Okay? So people associate sitting Shiva. That's the way you say it in English. You sit Shiva. And they assume, therefore, if you know a little bit of Hebrew, that that's what Shiva means. Because it comes from Shivti. I shall dwell, I shall sit in the house of the Lord forever. That's wrong. Shiva is spelled with an ayin, and it means seven. It means seven and refers to the 7 days of mourning. And if a Shabbat would cancel, then you would never have 7 days of mourning.
What about Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur?
Oh, we'll get to that. We're going to get to that. That's here. And you'll see the Mishnah is very interesting because we follow hardly anything in this Mishnah.
Is there any etymological connection between Shiva and Shvua?
Shivua meaning an oath?
Yeah.
An oath?
Just occurred to me.
Not that I know of, but it's an interesting thought to speculate on. Not that I know of.
I can see a vague connection.
Not that I know of.
The Rashi suggests that in his time, if the festival began less than 3 days after the burial, that they then did continue the Shiva.
Where is that in Rashi? Where are you reading?
I mean, he's saying that it's...
Where are you reading?
Why Shlosha Yamin? Because it's a special a special meaning and significance, so that you would want to.
Oh, you mean the fact that he says that it's Yemei HaBechi,
yeah,
the 3 days of intense grief. Yeah, he's not necessarily saying that that was what it was in his time, because it wasn't. By the end of the period of the Talmud, we know what it is. In this chapter, it's already decided. It's clear what the law is. So by Rashi's time, it couldn't have been what the Mishnah was. But he's simply explaining the logic of the Mishnah. In a way, you want to know what that logic is, especially because we don't do it that way. So it's got to be a logic if they actually took that point of view. And the logic is those 3 days are special.
Isn't it redundant to say that the holidays stop it and they're not counted?
Correct. Well, no, it's not necessarily redundant.
It's possible that the holiday would count, but there would be nothing after the holiday.
Correct. That's correct. And you're dealing with... It's not clear. That one phrase that you point to, Einan Olim, it's not clear what it applies to. And among the commentators, they are not sure that it should be read with the phrase before it, for exactly the reason that you're raising. Right, that there's a certain parallelism. Parallelism to the language. But some of the commentators actually refer this back now to the first comment and not to the comment that immediately precedes it. Okay? All right, now let's take Rabban Gamliel Omer. Rabban Gamliel says... I want to read 19. 19 is important. Let's read note number 19. Okay, Rabbi Eliezer. Now remember, we're reading Rabbi Eliezer. We've read the sages, and now we are reading other... Oh, no, we aren't up to 19 yet. We're only up to 18. I'm sorry. Let's keep going. The Mishnah... Now we read Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Mi shecharav Beit HaMikdash atzeret k'shabbat. Since the destruction of the temple, Shavuot is dealt with like a Shabbat. That is to say that as on Shabbat, Shabbat is not mafsik, it doesn't cut anything off. Okay? And it counts as part of the counting. So Rabbi Eliezer says that is the case for Shavuot after the destruction of the temple. Okay, now let's look at number 19. According to Rabbi Eliezer, the reason for the distinction between the Sabbath and the festivals is as follows. By rights, the festivals too should not have interfered with the course of Shiva. Get the logic here. By rights, logically, the festival should not have interfered with the course of Shiva. Shiva could continue right through a festival, as it does through the Sabbath, with the days of the festival counting toward the 7 days of Shiva. All right? However, the restrictions of Shiva would certainly not be observed on the festival, since that would conflict with the mitzvah of rejoicing on the festival. So it could be that the observance of the Shiva would stop, but the counting and maybe certain aspects of the Shiva would go on during the festival. However, inasmuch as Pesach and Sukkot both last for at least 7 days, were they to count toward the 7 days of Shiva, there would never be any days of Shiva left to observe after the festival. Do you get that? That's a very important logical point here. Inasmuch as Pesach and Sukkot both last for at least 7 days, were they to count toward the 7 days of Shiva, there would never be any days of Shiva left to observe after the festival. Okay? Therefore, since the occurrence of a festival will in any case interrupt the ordinary observance of Shiva, right? Under any circumstances, even if you were to allow it to happen, it's going to cut it off. The rabbis legislated either that the festival cancel Shiva altogether, where Shiva began 3 days before the festival, according to the Mishnah, or that the count of 7 days be suspended during the festival and resumed after the festival, where Shiva began fewer than 3 days before the festival, or where burial took place on the festival itself. But in the case of the Sabbath, where this consideration does not apply, the 7 days of Shiva are counted right through the Sabbath. So you see the logic behind it? It's the fact that the holidays are 7 days, which would allow for the possibility that if you had a Shiva involved there, okay, you wouldn't be able to really observe the Shiva. Okay? And it could be, if a Shiva began in the beginning of the holiday, there'd be no Shiva at all. Okay? Absolutely none at all. So to avoid that, in effect, since you're not going to be observing it anyway, because you can't observe these things since it's Yom Tov, and to give you the opportunity to at least have a little bit of Shiva, okay, actually they then cut it off. So that what we would have thought would have been, you know, people will sometimes say, it's not fair that you cut off the Shiva. Not fair that you cut off the... Well, the reason that they say that is because, in essence, they don't observe the Yom Tov. But if you're going to observe the Yom Tov, what's the alternative? The alternative is that you keep counting the Shiva and you observe the Yom Tov, in which case you would allow for the possibility of absolutely no Shiva at all if the burial took place at the very beginning. Okay? So in effect, the system that we have at least allows for some Shiva before the Yom Tov. Okay? And of course it's more so in the time of the Mishnah, since they required 3 days. They actually required 3 days before the regel could cancel the rest of the Shiva. And of course, what would happen in their times, and there's a great logic, I think that theirs is really a logical system, because they would say you should have certain Shiva. If you didn't have enough, you should have it afterwards. All right? You should have it after the holiday.
Under that system, if you had 1 day, you would resume at the
end of the
have 6 more days.
Correct. Yep. Under that system, you would have that.
It also makes sense, though, that you couldn't have Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, because if you had Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot, it's all break. And that's a huge chunk of time that's all right next to each other, all those holidays. So if Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur broke up a Shiva, and Sukkot broke up, as you know. It's like a whole month where you basically couldn't have effective Shivas.
Well, you couldn't have complete Shivas. Well, it'd be a long time when you would. Yeah. Of course, and their system perhaps solves that problem. It's not the law. Yeah. In effect, the law does exactly what you're worried about. The way our system is today, Rosh Hashanah completely cancels the Shiva. Okay. Yom Kippur completely cancels the Shiva. Sukkot completely cancels the Shiva. And as a matter of fact, you could have a situation where and Shavuot is exactly the same thing. But let's first of all look at this. Look at this, because this is, first of all, what is the difference with Shavuot? Why is Shavuot different?
It's not a 7 day.
Because it's only a 1 day. Exactly. That's what makes Shavuot unique. Now, the reason that it is unique here is the way he puts it is, Mishachara bet ha-mikdash atzeret b'shabbat, k'shabbat. Only after the destruction of the temple. Because before the destruction of the temple, there was a period of a week which began with Shavuot, which was special.
Oh.
It was special. Not observed as the holiday. But if you did not bring your obligatory sacrifice on the holiday, you could bring it for a period of 7 days. And therefore, there was a 7 day period. Now, during Pesach, for example, or during Sukkot, where you have sacrifices that are brought, you can in effect do it throughout the holiday. The problem with Shavuot is it's only 1 day. To us, it's 2 days, but realize in the land of Israel to this day, it's 1 day. Shavuot is only 1 day.
The 7th day or the 8th day is also a holiday.
When it will be here?
Why? Not for Shavuot. Shavuot is 1 day.
Passover.
Yeah, Passover, yes. But in Israel, the 7th day is a holiday. The 1st day is Yom Tov, and the 7th day is Yom Tov. For us, the 1st and the 2nd day is Yom Tov. The 7th and the 8th days are Yom Tov. Shavuot, there is one day, here it's 2 days. Okay?
When it will be here one day?
Yeah. Never.
Never?
Never. No, why should it be one day? If you want one day, you go to live in Israel. Sure.
That's the way they force them to go to Israel.
I have a friend who went Aliyah. She says to me, I said to her, she says, you know, all the other reasons for going on Aliyah were secondary. The real reason was second day Yom Tov.
No, but the reason for the second day of Yom Tov is the way they promote the holidays far away from Jerusalem. But nowadays, there are...
Doesn't matter. Min ha'gavotenu bi'adenu. That's the law, is the custom of our ancestors, is the custom, and we cannot change it. We tried to change it, and it didn't work. You know, it's fascinating.
You didn't
The conservative rabbis a number of years ago tried to change to one day Yom Tov. It was a big movement, the conservative movement. It failed completely. Failed completely. And the reform, and it's coming back in the reform.
You're, the second day.
Sure. You know, we even had here. We used to, for years in Or Zarua, we had the second day of Yontif, we had the reform rabbis would come to daven there. Remember that? Where the rabbi from Central Synagogue came here religiously for years on the second day of Rosh Hashanah. And in Rodev Shalom also, he used to come here on the second day of Rosh Hashanah. And today, why don't they come? Because they're in their own shuls. The Reform movement brought back the second day of Rosh Hashanah. You could have predicted this? I in a million years never would have predicted it.
Isn't Rosh Hashanah 2 days in Israel?
Correct. So Rosh Hashanah is a little bit unique. Just wait. Just wait. You're going to see the other holidays come back as well. Because some of it makes such good sense. Look what's going to happen. Where you have two families. This is going to happen to the Reform movement. Listen to me. You heard it here first. You heard it here first. You have two families, right? High level of divorce. Okay? Whose family do you go to for the Seder? Only one Seder. Okay, only one Seder. Whose family do you go to?
Like Thanksgiving 2 days.
All right. I got a good solution for you. You have two Sedarim, you can split up. You go to two different people. Okay? Some of this is, we've developed, this is the power of Minhag Avotenu Bi'adenu. We've adapted to this over a period of almost 2,000 years. Never change it. Absolutely never change it, because it's such a creative adaptation. It solves so many of our problems that though it causes some problems, undoubtedly, it also solves many problems. Many people will tell me the only decent holiday they have is the second day of the holiday, because the first day of the holiday is such a wreck. They're so worn out from the first, because to get to the holiday is so tense if you observe the holiday. To just make it, finally, the second day you can take it easy. That's why we always loved, last year we had this wonderful Pesach, because we had the first Seder on Saturday night. Best Seder, the best Sedarim in the world are on Saturday night. Whatever it is, the fact is that the day before, if you observe the Sabbath, you go into Pesach relaxed. And normally, nobody goes into Pesach relaxed. Some people less relaxed than others, to say the least.
So what you say, this custom, now the Israelis will have second days.
Then they have to come to the diaspora.
No, they
can't. No, they can't. They can't. They have to come here. Okay. There's certain, you know, there are problems in the diaspora, but there are certain advantages. Okay. All right, so here we have Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Mishachara Bet HaMikdash, Atzeret Keshabbat. So once the temple is destroyed, so that's only now where you don't have the 7 day period of what's called Tashlumim, when you can make up a sacrifice and it still has a little bit of the air of the Yontif, then he felt that it should be considered just the same as the Shabbat. For the same logic. It's not a 7 day period. And therefore all the things that come from that previous logic that we read about wouldn't apply, because it's only a 1 day holiday. Rabban Gamliel Omer, Rosh Hashanah v'Yom HaKippurim k'regalim. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are dealt with as festivals. Namely, if you had 8 days before, it would cut it off for the Shloshim. Eight, because that's what the Mishnah says.
For Shloshim.
And as far as Shiva goes, if you had three, it would cut them off. Right. V'chachamim omrim, and the sages say, lo kedivrei zeh v'lo kedivrei zeh. They don't agree with either Rabbi Eliezer or with Rabban Gamliel. Instead, atzeret kiragalim, atzeret shavuot functions like a regal, namely, it's mafsik, it cuts off either the 3 days of Shiva, or after 8 days, it cuts off the Shloshim. The Yom HaKippurim k'Shabbat. Rosh Hashanah v'Yom HaKippurim k'Shabbat.
Huh?
Since they are sort of one day, because Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah is at a very, very early stage, is 2 days. Do you know why Rosh Hashanah is 2 days?
It's
in Israel.
So why is it 2 days?
It's one long day.
So why is it one long day? You're right. You know the language. Yama richta. But there's actually a very simple logic to it, why it has to be. Before you had a fixed calendar, the problem was, as you said, when did you sight the moon? Because we have a lunar calendar, right? So the problem is a Rosh Chodesh problem. That's why we have some days 1 day Rosh Chodesh, some days 2 days Rosh Chodesh, okay? Because it's a problem of sighting the moon. And the Rosh Chodesh would not be until the moon was actually sighted. All right? Now, when you're dealing with the middle of the month, when the festivals come, that's already, you know, when the months begin. So you know when the 15th day of the month is. You also know when the 6th day of the month is for Shavuot. You know what day of the month you can't know? Rosh Hashanah? You don't know the first day of the month. You don't know the first day of the month. That's the problem with Rosh Hashanah. It's the only one of our festivals that begins at the beginning of the month. And since the beginning of the month is crucial, right, early on, the month of Elul was, the problem was with Elul whether to have 2 days Rosh Chodesh in Elul. And early on they decided in effect to have two days Rosh Chodesh, but they just switched it, you know, pushed it forward a little bit to have 2 days of Rosh Hashanah. That way Rosh Hashanah theoretically begins on the second day or on the first day. You don't know which one, but it doesn't matter because you sort of covered your bases by having 2 days, just the way you do in certain months by having 2 days of Rosh Chodesh. So, and Rosh Hashanah is unique because it's the only biblical holiday that is mandated to come on the first day of the month. That's the logic behind
it. The double Rosh Chodesh day is fixed?
Now it's fixed. Yeah, now it's fixed. In the fixed calendar, it's fixed.
Oh, it has nothing to do with astronomy.
It does, because it's an astronomical compromise. It's a compromise in a fixed calendar with an astronomical reality. Because you have a month, roughly 29 and a half days. Okay?
Right.
That's the moon goes around the Earth in 29 and a half days. But you can't have a calendar that's 29 and a half days long.
Right.
You can have a calendar that's 29 days and one that's 30 days. So if you have 1 month that's 29, and 1 month that's 30,
right,
in 2 months, you've solved the problem of 229 and a half day months. So roughly, that's how the Jewish calendar works. Sometimes you have a 30-day month, sometimes you have a 29-day month. Where you have a 30-day month, the problem with that is that it could be that the moon would be recited on the 30th day, because you're adding a day. Sometime in that day, which is actually only half a day, we're adding a whole day. Okay? We've added a whole day. So therefore, the way our months are set up, they're roughly 1 month 29, 1 month 30. And that's because of the astronomical reality of a 29 and a half day month. Because, in fact, it's not 29 and a half days. It's 29 and a half plus certain number of minutes and a certain number of seconds. It doesn't work exactly like that. And that's why you don't have it every other month is 2 days Rosh Chodesh. The system is worked out over a period of 19 years to be perfect. But not over a very short period of time.
Every 19 years, the
secular
all the dates of the
they're
Jewish
the same.
And the Christian calendar and the day of the weeks and the times are synchronized.
Okay. But that's the theory. That's the theory then. The theory is based on the reality of the lunar calendar.
So in the 30-day months, you have 2 days
Rosh Chodesh. That's why when you have 2 days Rosh Chodesh, the first day Rosh Chodesh is not the first day of the month.
Oh.
It's the last day of the previous month. It's the 30th day of the previous month. But it's celebrated as Rosh Chodesh because it could be that during that day, the moon has risen.
That's because it could be the last half day.
Correct.
Last half day.
The last half of that day.
Last Tuesday night, I was walking in the harbor at night with my Israeli colleague and a Jewish professor of physics from CCNY. And they looked up and said, oh, look how beautiful. It's just the beginning of the moon. I said, of course, it's Rosh Chodesh Adar. And they looked at me.
Because you know the calendar. As somebody who spends, as a sailor, when I find myself too, the sailors are all trying to, to make sure they can remember it. I have no problem because I daven hallel in the morning and I know what the tides are going to be.
Exactly.
If you follow a Jewish calendar, if you're a sailor, you're already ahead of the game. You know the whole system. You know when it's 15th of the month because you're very aware of the middle of the month. It's you look at these things. Just pay attention to them because they're a part of the calendar. Okay? Okay, now let's look at note 20. Rabban Gamliel understands the reason for the distinction between the Sabbath and the festivals differently. According to him, even the Sabbath ought by rights to cancel Shiva. Remember what he says? Rosh Hashanah v'yom ha-kippurim kirigalim. That's Rabban Gamliel's position, that Rosh Hashanah and Yom HaKippurim are like... Kirigalim, like festivals, correct. According to Rabban Gamliel, even the Sabbath ought by rights to cancel Shiva, since the restrictions of Shiva are not observed on the Sabbath. That is to say, most of them are not. However, were that to be the case, then no Shiva could ever be completed without interruption, since every seven-day period includes one Sabbath. It was therefore legislated that the Sabbath should not interrupt, but rather should count toward the 7 days of Shiva. Since this consideration does not apply to Rosh Hashanah and to Yom Kippur, that's the key here, even though they're one day, they're not one day every week. They are events that occur only once a year. So you couldn't, generally speaking, you will have a full week. If it happens to be the week of Rosh Hashanah, no, you won't. But since we were not sure whether to count it as a Sabbath or to count it as a regel, it makes more sense to count it as a regel, according to Rabban Gamliel. Okay? Because though indeed the Sabbath is like it, the truth is the Sabbath also should have cut it off. And the only reason that we don't have the Sabbath cutting it off is because it would come every week and you never have a Shiva. Since that reason doesn't apply for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, even though they are one day, therefore they're treated as a regal.
But Shiva is canceled from the regal because of the mitzvah rejoicing on the festival. Yom Kippur is not a joyous, you're not rejoicing on a festival. It's more...
Well, it's also true for Rosh Hashanah. That's why Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are also in the special category. Because they're not really the same. They're really not
public,
the same.
Holiday of the whole community. And
that's correct. In effect, that is the law. But the technical, what you just said, is also true. On Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, for example, we don't recite Hallel. Because they're not joyous festivals. They're festivals of fear and trembling.
Okay.
Okay? So the analogy is not a perfect analogy. Okay? That's why it's a question. That's exactly why it's a question. Okay, since this consideration has not applied to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, they cancel Shiva. Likewise, according to Rabban Gamliel, Shavuot, even after the destruction of the temple, cancels Shiva. Right? For him, all of these things, including the Shabbat, but the Shabbat is a special reason. Everything else, though, doesn't have that special reason, doesn't come once a week, including Shavuot. And therefore, Shavuot is dealt with like Eregel, according to Rabban Gamliel. Right? Even after the destruction, cancel Shiva. Other Rishonim explain the distinction between the Sabbath and the festival differently. And this is interesting, worthwhile noting. They write that on a festival there is a commandment to rejoice, what you just said, Alan. Okay? The festival has a mitzvah of simcha, which stands in diametric opposition to the state of mourning and cancels it. On the Sabbath, in contrast, although one is enjoined to enjoy the Sabbath, there is no actual requirement of rejoicing. Hence, the Sabbath is not entirely antithetical to the state of mourning, and therefore does not cancel it. What that position, of course, does not answer is, what about Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur?
Right.
Are they more like the Sabbath, or are they more like the festival? I would argue that they're more like the Sabbath than the festival, perhaps.
Well, Yom Kippur is Shabbos.
Because, exactly. It can be on Shabbos, and it's called Shabbat Shabbaton, a Sabbath of Sabbaths, which is why you have the first part of the reasoning. That is the majority point of view of most of the commentators, but the notes bring in this last point because some of the commentators say that also.
Can you give an example of the difference between rejoicing as opposed to enjoying the Sabbath?
Right. Tanug on Shabbat. Rejoicing, well, let's see.
Does that mean you're bringing sacrifices? Is that,
yes, it meant specifically bringing a sacrifice.
And you do not bring the sacrifice?
There's no sacrifice brought on the Sabbath.
Well, I thought there was a...
There's a communal sacrifice that's brought every day. And there's a Musaf sacrifice that is brought. But festal sacrifices of joy, Chagiga, is not brought on the Sabbath.
Okay.
It's only brought on the Yom Tov.
And those are individual.
Those are individual, correct. They are not communal. An individual brings a Chagiga sacrifice, not the community. Okay? Questions? Good so far? Okay, let's see if there's any more to the Mishnah. If there isn't, no, I think we should call it there, because then we'll begin with the Gemara at the beginning of the next session. Okay?
Thank you.